I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection, from the source of the book and movie of The English Patient. Michael Ondaatje's new novel, Anil's Ghost, is set in Sri Lanka's civil war of the 80s and 90s, recent enough to feel contemporary and close enough to the mayhem and terror of the Balkans and Somalia and Colombia and Sierra Leone this week to feel universal. It was a 100 years war with modern weaponry, Michael Ondaatje writes about the situation in Sri Lanka. And backers on the sidelines in safe countries, a war sponsored by gun and drug runners. It became evident that political enemies were secretly joined in financial arms deals. The reason for war, as they say, was war. This is the setting in which Michael Ondaatje's characters are trying to stanch the bleeding, salvage some history, restore some shattered surfaces of order and grace. Anil, the character in the title, is a young medical detective, a Sri Lankan woman returned from the United States, who makes it her mission to identify one victim by his skeleton, to tell one story that will stand for the thousands of dead. Another key character, with another elaborate skill that Michael Ondaatje lovingly observes, is the model-building artificer Ananda, who builds back a face on that skeleton's skull. Another critical perspective comes from the young surgeon working past exhaustion to stitch up the mind-blasted, crucified bodies that keep flooding his emergency ward. I wanted to find one law to cover all of living, another character confesses. I found fear. Connection listeners, there was catastrophe in the beauty of The English Patient. The catastrophe is a little closer in Anil's Ghost. There's redemptive beauty here, too. Make the connection with Michael Ondaatje and his world at 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Welcome back to The Connection, Michael Ondaatje. We love this book. It's an enormously interesting piece of writing and poetry and digressions and description. But at the core of it is this question of how we deal every day with what we know of the terror and violence in the world all around us. I wish you just start with each of those three characters I mentioned, Anil, Ananda, and Gamini, the detective in effect, the restorer, and the doctor. Which of these sort of expresses what piece of your own perspective on Sri Lanka, on this scene?
Well, I think, what tends to happen with any novel is that the author sees himself in all the characters. And in this book, there are really these three, and then there's the fourth one, Sarath, who's Gamini's brother, who's an archaeologist. So, I think I began alongside Anil, the woman who returns to Sri Lanka, the country that she was born in, but now feels a stranger to because she's grown up in the West, has been educated in the West. So that kind of career has, in a way, echoes mine or parallels mine. So I came alongside that character for the first part of the book. And what tends to happen in the novel is that Sarath, who is the person she's teamed with, the archaeologist, to do these investigations, in a way seems very kind of mysterious to her, and she can't reach him, and she doesn't really know where he stands politically. And he takes her on this very circuitous trip around the island during the investigation, and in a way it is a kind of education of Anil as well, of the place. So
she has this very scientific and maybe Western notion that she can nail a big question with her detective work. It's much less clear exactly what he's looking for. There's another figure who I think carries a lot of your head, Palipana, a now blind archaeologist and a kind of poetic, imaginative historian of the place, who's trying to figure out in the very long, long centuries, millennia history, kind of what is going on. He's part of it too.
Yes, I mean, he actually is a character I kind of loved making. And this book was so dark in some ways. I mean, it seemed so chaotic, what was happening in the novel. Whenever I was getting utterly depressed with it, I would kind of go back to that sequence and rework it for no reason at all, just to be able to kind of reside in that company. You know, it's almost like having a
in
retreat.
In which sequence?
The scene with Palipana, where he's in the Grove of Ascetics, and there's Palipana and Anil and Sarath, and they're just talking about history, but on a huge level. Palipana is quoting stuff from the 5th century, and they're trying to solve this problem of the head of the skeleton, and he's trying to put a perspective on all this. And it was very important for me. And one of the things I really wanted to do in the book was to get into the whole business of archaeology, because when we talk about a country like Bosnia or Rwanda, we always read it in a very kind of quick contemporary way, and we don't really know the context of the country. We don't know the civilization or the culture, so we interpret it only through, you know, an act of violence that seems inexplicable. And in some odd way, to look at the country through archaeology and to realize that some of these acts of violence are not new, they're ancient as well as contemporary, but they come from a great civilization, is interesting.
This to me is the great the great invitation in the book, and it's the great sort of rebuke to journalism. Most of us, what little we know about war in these places, it comes to us from journalists, and we know the journalists sort of fly in, stay at the Days Inn, or get a quick tour of who's up, who's down, who's right, who's left, and then leave. The invitation from Palipana is to penetrate that horizon, get inside it. Will we ever? How will we begin doing that? We do it a lot in this novel, praise God. It's a wonderful, humbling passage into the imaginative and the historical world of people we know practically nothing about. But how might we really do that?
I really don't know. I mean, I think maybe I don't always trust the imagination, but in some ways what I wanted to do was get past all those symbols, you know, the generals, the presidents, the prime ministers, the worldview of the culture of Asia and all that stuff, and try and kind of hold a kind of portrait of a people who are in this horrific state, in this torment, who are trying to live in create a kind of civilization out of it. And that was the only way I felt like I'd do it without being, you know, dated in a sense of having an opinion about this political party when next week it might do something horrific. So I wanted to kind of write about a political situation, but not write about politics with a capital P. It was, how does someone like Garmany, who's a doctor, deal with the war, and what are his emotional responses to these things, which tend not to get written about.
You answer in the book how Garmany deals with the war, and as I read it, I thought, this sounds like the author talking. Garmany is in a hospital. It's a kind of an assembly line of broken bodies, and he's sleeping minimally. He's completely exhausted by what he's doing. You write, the hospital would run out of painkillers during the first week of any offensive. You were without self in those times, lost among the screaming. Garmany watches children in this place. They're unaware of their parents' losses. 50 yards away, he says, in emergency, he had heard grown men scream for their mothers as they were dying. Wait for me. I know you are here. And then there's this very wonderful passage about Garmany's mind. He says, this was when he stopped believing in man's rule on earth. He turned away from every person who stood up for a war, or the principle of one's land, or pride of ownership, or even personal rights. All of those motives ended up somehow in the arms of careless power. One was no worse and no better than the enemy. He believed only in the mothers sleeping against their children, the great sexuality of spirit in them, the sexuality of care, so the children would be confident and safe during the night.
Yeah, well, that I think is where Garmany kind of came, you know, is closest to what he feels about everything. And the irony is, of course, he's a very kind of wounded man himself. You know, he's almost limited himself purely to dealing with the cure of the people. His private life is in ruins, and when he meets someone he's interested in talking to or becoming part of their life, he's almost too nervous to step into that relationship. But as a person who kind of deals magically almost with everything that's going on around him, he's remarkable. He's a character who kind of sort of appeared halfway through the book for me, and was, thank God he appeared, because he was, you know, the kind of an essential force in the book.
There's another doctor, a surgeon, who'd been working with him in an earlier place, and another wonderful description of the two of them, the work they were doing. They were not working for any cause or political agenda. They had found a place a long way from governments and media and financial ambition. They had originally come to the Northeast for a three-month shift, and in spite of the lack of equipment, the lack of water, not one luxury except now and then a tin of condensed milk sucked in a car while being surrounded by jungle, they had stayed for 2 years, or three in some cases longer. It was the best place to be. Once, after performing surgery for almost 5 hours straight, Skanda said, "The important thing is to be able to live in a place or a situation where you must use your sixth sense all the time." I'd like you to talk about the sixth sense.
Well, it's that awareness that every part of your body is active, and every part of your spirit and your imagination is active, and you're used fully. I think that's what's going on with these people, and to get to that stage, there are people who have in a way escaped a civilization that is at war, just as Palipana in a way escapes his civilization. When I was doing research on the book, one of the things that I wanted to find some hope in this book, some hope in this world, and I was in Sri Lanka quite a lot, and it was really when I met some of these doctors and I spent some time with them in the Northeast, that was where I found this kind of, incredible dedication. There were people who were like, had nothing to do with the government anymore, nothing to do with official hospitals. They were running the hospitals, but then they would go further into the jungles, set up places that they could go and visit and meet patients in kind of abandoned, ruins. And there was a tremendous excitement. It was quite joyous, and they felt very kind of liberated and very empowered and completely free. And they were not just working as doctors, they were going out, borrowing washing machines and sheets from hotels and stuff like that to use in the hospitals. It was a remarkable group of people, and they're still there.
They had escaped it in some fashion, but of course they were up to their waist in it.
Well, yes, this is a strange thing, but they did feel utterly free in this situation. But I mean, they were the ones who were having to deal with all this the chaos of battle and people having their limbs blown off and so forth.
There are so many places in the world where this kind of thing is happening. We were talking about it last week in terms of Sierra Leone and Congo, Ethiopia, Eritrea, not to mention, recent memories of Somalia, the Balkans, Rwanda. And we were puzzling, particularly in Africa, but in Sri Lanka as well, all over the place. What is this, what do you take to be this virus that scares people so much, that takes over an island nation like Sri Lanka, and accounts for all the horrendous things that you describe, including a truck driver, for example, being dragged out of his truck and nailed live to the tarmac, kind of crucified there on a highway. What in the world brought us to this kind of thing?
Well, that's a huge question. I have no idea how to answer that and to know what that virus is. I think what's more startling, I really don't know. It's something that, seems like the fate of this century, where we have gone back to that kind of feudal battling, over things that we had hoped had been resolved between, religions and cultures. But it seems to be going on and on. I think what is really difficult for us in the West to understand, though, is how people in that situation can continue to live a normal life. And I think that's what's startling. I mean, one bomb goes off in America, in a city, and there's complete chaos. A love bug, you know, puts this country into chaos. And yet here you've got a situation where you've got a population who are living with this chaos the whole time, and yet they have a kind of daily life. They have to go out and buy food in the stores, and they have to kind of keep that civilization going. And to me, that's in a remarkably heroic and complicated and subtle way of dealing with such a thing. And so all the kind of intricacies of someone like Sarath, who kind of says, well, we can find the truth, but the truth is dangerous sometimes. You have to kind of wait for the right moment to reveal the truth. Or Ghamini insisting on not even looking out into why these things are happening, but just heal them, heal them, heal them. So that seems to be going on. That's what interested me about these people.
Hmm. Are they too tolerant of it? I mean, I know what you mean, that the yeah. United States is terribly vulnerable, a love bug, and the sky falls. But on the other hand, we'd have the means to stop this kind of the depredation, the cruelty in this book that is both very personal and also systematic and highly organized. That it would be crushed in some fashion. In this country, at the price of maybe putting half the population in prison, but
right, no, exactly. Well, this is much easier to do it here than in a country like Sri Lanka. I think you've got a much more powerful government at work. You've got a government in Sri Lanka that in the 80s was fighting a war on two sides. They were fighting the terrorists in the north. They were fighting a party that at that time was called the JDP, which was a sort of a right wing insurgent group. So that they were being battled on both sides. And while the government did things that were terrible, one can almost see the necessity of it to try and kind of control some kind of order. And, you know, if anything like this happened in North America or even Europe, it'd be kind of crushed in minutes without any kind of, you know, consideration for other human rights, perhaps.
1-800-423-8255 is the connection phone. The novelist Michael Ondaatje, the poet, novelist of The English Patient, and now of Anil's Ghost, is our guest. 1-800-423-TALK. Sam is on the line.
Hi, Mr. Ondaatje. First, I want to say I haven't read this book, but I look forward to reading it. I read The English Patient, and just a throwaway for all those who haven't read and just saw the movie, I just want to say how much greater it is as a work of art than the movie. I hope people read it.
Thank you.
I had a whole bunch of stuff that's similar to, you know, I worked in Sri Lanka for a while with Air Lanka. I'm also moved. I'm an Israeli who came here at about the age of 10. So, and what I wanted to ask you was when I went back to Israel, I had this weird feeling where it was where I was born, and I have a lot of feelings about. But talking to people in there and trying to understand, I felt like, because I hadn't grown up there, I didn't have the right, or I didn't have the right to almost state an opinion, because I didn't grow up and I didn't really know what was truly there. So when I listened a lot, but I found it hard to say anything. And I was wondering whether you had anything like that about coming back to Sri Lanka and trying to understand what was going on.
Very definitely. I think, you know, that feeling you have is something that is very, very delicate thing to kind of try and get over. And quite honestly, I didn't try and get over it. And this is why I even now hesitate from the distance of 5,000 miles away to say, this should happen and this should happen and this should happen, because I don't think I have the right to do that. You know, that's a decision that has to be made within the country. And when I was writing the book, I intentionally didn't ask direct questions to do with how should this be stopped and so forth. I was there much more as a witness or as a listener, and I just travel around and listen to people talking, you know, witness what the doctors were doing and so forth.
Yeah, I also wonder whether you're familiar with Sebald, the guy who wrote a book about immigrants.
Yes, I love that book. Yes. Sebald is, I think, one of the best writers in the world today.
What is the book?
There's a book called The Emigrants, and he's written a second one called The Rings of Saturn. This is a German writer who lives in England, and he's quite wonderful. It's half fiction, half non-fiction writing, and he's a marvelous stylist.
Sam, you endorse that?
I totally do, and a pleasure to talk to you, and I look forward to reading your new book.
Thank you.
That's something new, and I didn't know Sebald, you better give the whole credit.
Okay, his name is W.G. Sebald, S-E-B-A-L-D, and the first book he wrote was The Emigrants, and the more recent one is called The Rings of Saturn.
Hmm. Good to know. I'd love you to read some of this book in your own voice. It has so much in it, and I don't know exactly where you want to begin.
I'll read a bit that comes at the beginning, where Anil is working with the forensic team in Guatemala.
Pre-Sri Lanka.
Pre-Sri Lanka. When the team reached the site at 5:30 in the morning, one or two family members would be waiting for them, and they would be present all day while Anil and the others worked, never leaving. They spelled each other, so someone always stayed, as if to ensure that the evidence would not be lost again. This vigil for the dead, for these half-revealed forms. During the night, plastic sheeting covered the site, weighted down with stones or pieces of iron. The families knew the approximate hour the scientists would arrive. They removed the sheeting and got closer to the submerged bones, until they heard the whine of the four-wheel drive in the distance. One morning, Anil found a naked footprint in the mud. Another day, a petal. They would boil up tea for the forensic team. In the worst hours of the Guatemalan heat, they held up a serape or banana leaf to provide shade. There was always the fear, double-edged, that it was their son in the pit, or that it was not their son, which meant there would be further searching. If it became clear that the body was a stranger, then, after weeks of waiting, the family would rise and leave. They would travel to other excavations in the Western Highlands. The possibility of their lost son was everywhere. One day, Anil and the rest of the team walked to a nearby river to cool off during their lunch break. On returning, they saw a woman sitting within the grave. She was on her haunches, her legs under her, as if in formal prayer, elbows in her lap, looking down at the remains of the two bodies. She had lost a husband and a brother during an abduction in this region a year earlier. Now it seemed as if the men were asleep beside each other on a mat in the afternoon. She had once been the feminine string between them, the one who brought them together. They would return from the fields and enter the hut, eat the lunch she had made, and sleep for an hour. Each afternoon of the week, she was part of this. There are no words Anil knows that can describe, even for just herself, the woman's face. But the grief of love in that shoulder she will not forget, still remembers. The woman rose to her feet when she heard them approach and moved back, offering them room to work.
The grief of love in that shoulder. We don't forget that either. The phone's 1-800-423-8255 with the novelist Michael Ondaatje. Jody is on the line.
Hello, Mr. Ondaatje. It's such a privilege to talk to you. I grew up in London, Ontario, and I remember first reading your poetry in an anthology, I think called 15 Canadian Poets, and you're the first writer that I decided for myself I wanted to follow. And I've always felt so vindicated that you've become so famous since that time. I wanted to ask you about the relationship between running in the family, your family memoir about your family in Sri Lanka, and writing Anil's Ghost, which I've only just started reading now.
Well, I wrote Running in the Family around 1978 to 1982, and it was a book where I really went back to Sri Lanka for the first time since I'd left when I was 11, and I really was trying to piece together all these anecdotes and rumors of my family. And, you know, their generation in Sri Lanka was a much kind of wilder, perhaps more spoiled, kind of the jazz age kind of life that was lived there. And it was obviously party time, and it was also an exaggerated series of anecdotes. Whenever I would speak to someone, they would tell me a story, and when I'd go back the next day, the story would have been exaggerated even more, so I wouldn't get bored. So I decided to just, you know, believe everything I was told, and wrote this book with all this kind of wonderful parties and bad behavior and I mean, it's a quite a funny book, but it's a portrait of people who have sort of escaped, you know, or kind of avoided what's really going on in the world. And when I went back to work on his ghost, one of the things I did was, in fact, I stayed with some of my family there. I really stepped out of that family structure and wanted to meet people who were not part of a Colombo group. And so very intentionally went out of that and tried to kind of portray another version of the country.
Out of the Colombo 7, so to speak?
Yes.
is that the answer you expected, Jody, or wanted?
Part of what's behind my question is I had been invited by a friend who was teaching a course on South Asian literature, and she was teaching Running in the Family as part of it this spring. And I had been invited to lead the seminar on that because I'd followed your other work. And a number of the students in the class were South Asian, and they loved the book. They loved Running in the Family. They were very interested in it. But they were very puzzled by the fact that there didn't seem to be anything political in it at all. Mm-hmm. And that at the time you had been there doing the research that so much was happening in Sri Lanka. And right after doing that, I actually went on a trip to Cuba and went through Toronto. And I talked to my mother in the airport in Toronto, and she said, Ondaatje's got a new book. It's just
that. Jody, we got to take a break. Stand by. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Michael Ondaatje, Anil's Ghost Connection.
It is a wondrous music to dance alongside, and she has danced it with others on occasions of joy and gregariousness, carousing through a party with, it seemed, all her energy and her skin. But now, this is not a dance, does not contain even a remnant of the courtesy or sharing that is part of a dance. She is waking every muscle in herself, blindfolding every rule she lives by, giving every mental skill she has to the movement of her body. Only this will lift her backward into the air and pivot her hip to send her 2 feet over her. She stops when she is exhausted and can hardly move. She will crouch and lean there, lie on the stone. A leaf will come down, its click of applause. The music continues, furious like blood moving for a few more minutes in a dead man. She lies under the sound and witnesses her brain coming back, lighting its candle in the dark, and breathes in and breathes out, and breathes in and breathes out.
This is the Sri Lankan woman who's been trained in medicine in London and the United States, who's come back to Sri Lanka. What happens to her head through this whole process of trying to track down the identity of one skeleton and one skull as a sort of symbolic one among the many of the victims?
Well, I think one of the things that occurs for the first third of the book is that it seems like a more traditional search novel of some kind of trying to identify the skeleton, and if she can identify it with Sarath as something that was killed, that was killed recently, then there's a possible person to blame for this thing. And that is really the path that the book takes, but then as the book goes on, she and Sarath find themselves in a much larger story, a much larger political danger than one of trying to identify a skeleton. So without giving too much away, that's the main mark. But she, in a way, does have that education of the country, you know, and by the end is educated in a much more startling way, I think.
Jody, you're still there.
Yes, I am.
You were in the middle of a story.
Well, what I was going to remark on is that after having taught Running in the Family very recently and then picking up Anil's Ghost, which had just come out, when I read your author's note to it, it seemed to me that that summarized everything that had not been in Running in the Family. It was almost as though, you know, 20 years later you wrote the book you didn't write the first time, which is just a very terse note that says, you know, from the mid-1980s to the early 1990s, Sri Lanka was in a crisis that involved three essential groups, and then you outline what the political crisis was. And I know when I was teaching the students, many of whom, as I said, were South Asian, they were they had loved Running in the Family. They were very forgiving of the fact that you didn't take on hard political questions because you were writing about your family. And they understood that in some way that's a different kind of project. I felt there was a lot of pain and suffering also in Running in the Family as well. I didn't think you were running away from that, but that you were looking at them from a different lens, which is the lens of uncovering a family and the loss and people you didn't know and wanted to know and wanted to try to recover.
Yeah, I think one of the things is that you know, one cannot write everything in every book, and I think what with Running the Family really was, it began as a very personal book about my family and my father, and I did drop several clues, I think, in that book to say that these people had sort of avoided the main culture of the place. But, in this book it was a world of, hard politics. This is I'm going to read a section from the book which involves an episode on a train. There were police officers all over the train. The man got on carrying a bird cage with a miner in it. He walked through carriages, glancing at other passengers. There were no seats left, and he sat on the floor. He wore a sarong, sandals, a Gold Road T-shirt. It was a slow train, traveling through rock passes, then emerging into sudden vistas. He knew that a mile or so before they got to Kurunagala, there would be a tunnel, and the train would curve into the dark claustrophobia of it. A few windows would remain open. They needed fresh air, though it meant the noise would be terrible. Once past the tunnel, back into sunlight, they would be getting ready to disembark. He stood just as the train went into darkness. For a few moments there was the faint, muddy light of the bulbs, and then they went out. He could hear the bird talking. 3 minutes of darkness. The man moved quickly to where he remembered the government official was, beside the aisle. In the darkness he yanked him forward by his hair and wrapped the chain around his neck and began strangling him. He counted the seconds to himself in the darkness. When the man's weight fell against him, he still didn't trust him, didn't release his hold on the chain. He had a minute left. He stood and lifted the man into his arms. Keeping him upright, he steered him towards the open window. The yellow lights flickered on for a second. He might have been a tableau in someone's dream. He jerked the official off the ground and pushed him through the opening. The buffet of wind outside flung the head and shoulders backwards. He pushed him farther and then let go, and the man disappeared into the noise of the tunnel.
I'm so glad you read that little passage, a tour de force of kind of condensed narrative of a terrorist murder on a train by a man who gets on with a birdcage and a miner. It's a little, like so many things, it's just sort of one-page masterpiece of old-fashioned prose. It's also left me kind of shaking and scared as a kind of mini-description of a country at war, a faceless war. A little further on, you describe, you sort of, in a much more general term, you describe this whole country, in a fearful nation, you write, and this again could apply to so many different things, in a fearful nation, public sorrow was stamped down by the climate of uncertainty. If a father protested a son's death, it was feared another family member would be killed. If people you knew disappeared, there was a chance they might stay alive if you did not cause trouble. This was the scarring psychosis in the country. Death, loss, was unfinished, so you could not walk through it. There had been years of night visitations, kidnappings, or murders in broad daylight. The only chance was that the creatures who fought would consume themselves. All that was left of law was a belief in an eventual revenge toward those who had power. But it makes you wonder, how do these things end? And then when they end, how do they possibly heal? Do you have a notion?
No, I don't. I wish I had a notion to these big questions. But no, I mean, obviously there has to be some kind of peace and compromise in a peace solution. But, you know, it seems like it's self-feeding, this war. It's kind of, it's not a bit like Northern Ireland. Everyone knows someone who's died. Everyone feels they can't compromise because of these wounds that have already occurred. So I just don't know. It's so complicated and so intricate, you know, the politics of this country.
You know, we talk a lot, just at a political level, about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, which seems to, you know, in a horrible time, have set a marvelous example. Does it impress you?
It impresses me immensely. I think it's one of the great things, actually. It seems the first really remarkable thing that's happened, you know, in this century, to be able to forgive and also to record those crimes. I just don't know how that would work in Sri Lanka. It's just, you know, it's not a simple two-party problem. It's much more complicated than that in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that what's happened in South Africa is remarkable.
1-800-423-8255 makes the connection with the novelist Michael Ondaatje and his new novel, Anil's Ghost. Tara is on the line.
Hi, Mr. Ondaatje. Hi, Chris. Wonderful show as usual.
Thank you, Tara.
I haven't read the book. I look forward to it. But one thing I'd like you to comment on, and I'll take my answer off the air, is how Sri Lanka's Buddhism affects this conflict.
Well, the question is whether what's going on right now is a racial or religious war. One of the things about the Buddhism, which, you know, from a distance seems to be an ideal religion, it can also be very strict. And I think often the government finds it difficult to negotiate with the other groups because of the strictness of the Buddhist parties, in a way that it's not quite the religious right, but it's a similar kind of influence on the government. But having said that, you know, what Buddhism, you know, teaches us, what is great about Buddhism is something to do with peace and some kind of grace, and so there's an odd kind of mix there too.
Hmm. Tara, does that do it? Oh, she's gone. There are so many descriptions in this book. I mean, these are now kinds of set pieces that people look for in your writing. Descriptions of process, descriptions of people at work doing very unusual things, whether it's surgery or determining a person's age by the minute microscopic structure of their bones. One of the most interesting figures here, and we haven't talked about him enough, is Palipana, an older man, a man in his 70s who's been a historical archaeologist all his life, knowing the ancient history of Sri Lanka by its monuments. He's gone blind in the process, but he can still, as you suggest, sort of read history by his hand in a bucket of sand. There's a description on page 87 of Palipana at work. He is asked to hold the skull of the skeleton that they're trying to identify, and there's a wonderful picture of this man with, he has perhaps too much imagination, and he's gotten in professional trouble by making up history, but he also reads the physical evidence very, very carefully. There's a perfect description in Ondaatje's style of an arcane professional at work here. I wish you'd read it for us.
And also the other thing about him being blind, he can hear everything around him. Palipana fell silent. Anil washed his fingers, beautiful and thin, moving over the outlines of the skull Sarath had given him, his long fingernails at the supraorbital ridge, within the orbital cavities, then cupping the shape as if warming his palms on the skull, as if it were a stone from some old fire. He was testing the jaw's angle, the blunt ridge of its teeth. She imagined he could hear the one bird in the forest distance. She imagined he could hear South's sandals pacing, the scrape of his match, the sound of the fire roasting the tobacco leaf, as Sarath smoked his beedi a few yards away. She was sure he could hear all that, the light wind, the other fragments of noise that passed by his thin face, that glassy brown boniness of his own skull. And all the while, the blunt eyes looked out, piercing whatever caught them. His face was immaculately shaved. Had he done that, or was that the girl? Tell me what you think, you. He turned his head in Anil's direction.
What does Palipana, with his kind of millennial view of things, I mean, he sees 5,000 years of history in the place. What does he make of this war, do you suppose? He's in a kind of safe haven in his late in life, but also from the war itself.
Well, there seems to be a kind of, well, I think, on one side of this aspect of a war, and I think it happens in a lot of countries, is a sense of retreat from the world. And certainly he has retreated, but he's also retreated with his niece, whose parents have been killed. And so he's sort of got a young girl who's in trauma, essentially, with him. And all he can do in this place is just slowly coax her back into some kind of humanity and some faith in humanity. And so it's almost like everyone has a kind of personal agenda that's on a very small scale. Gamni will deal with whoever comes near him who's wounded. He treats them. Mm. Palipana, who's retreated from all the craziness of the world, now kind of helps this young girl trust him, and she trusts no one, having watched her parents die. And also he has this huge historical sense that, you know, this happens. You know, there's always brutality. There's always going to be brutality. People will destroy each other, and there's nothing we can do. And it's kind of such a... So even though he's quite a lyrical person, the portrait he has of the world is quite dark.
Hmm. Tara's question about Buddhism prompts me to ask about Ananda. Mm-hmm. Ananda has lost a wife to the war. She's disappeared. He's a broken man. He's a drunk. He's a former miner. But he also has a critically heroic role as the artificer. Artificer in many subtle definitions of that term, who reconstructs the skeleton, but also has an important role in reconstructing a broken Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
What is the freight that Ananda is carrying in this story?
Well, in some ways, Ananda is the outsider in the story. There's Anil and the two brothers, and they are part of a clan and a certain part of society, and then into their midst comes this guy who seems, at first glance, a complete drunk, and Anil is not fond of him at all, and in fact is quite scornful of what his worth is. And various things happen to their relationships over the next, you know, couple of hundred pages. And then there is a scene near the end where Ananda, in fact, does have to paint the eyes on this Buddha. And this is, in fact, I thought when I first heard about this that it was a medieval tradition and it stopped there. And then was amazed to find that it still occurs. And
painting the eyes. I wish you'd describe another one of these process, business, job, practical descriptions that you do so beautifully.
But the thing is, you know, the world is full of these things, and it's really kind of, it was really the luck of finding out about this thing. I mean, who would have thought that this, you know, still existed? And but what he does in the final stage of the creation of a Buddha statue is the artificer has to paint the eyes, but he cannot look at the eyes directly when he is painting them, because that's almost like a too personal, intimate connection with the god. So he has to have his back to the face, and someone holds up a mirror, and then he puts the paintbrush over his shoulder, and he paints the eye that way. And it can take, you know, an hour, it can take 3 minutes. And there's a scene where Ananda is on a very, very high statue looking out over the landscape, and he starts to kind of almost take on the eyes of a god, and he starts looking at nature and looking at the landscape around him with this kind of godlike sense, and it's quite moving at first, but then quite scary for someone. Anyway, in the end, he's the one who does not retreat from the world, does not take on that kind of godlike vista that, in a way, perhaps Polypona does.
But he is the artificer. He is the repairman.
Mm-hmm.
And the artist. And the Ondaatje, perhaps.
Possibly. that wasn't an intentional thing, but, you know, I think, in a way, everyone writes a kind of... I think all books, in my books, seem to have a artist. I mean, I think in some ways, Gamni, as a doctor, is as much an artist as Ananda is, you know, but certainly Ananda, who seems the least likely guy, in fact, to be the artist, is the real artist in the book.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Michael Ondaatje connection. Jill is on the line.
Hello?
Hello, Jill.
Good morning. What a treat. Well, Mr. Ondaatje, you're one of my two absolute favorite authors in the entire universe, and in fact, The English Patient is one of the three books I would clutch dearly to my chest if my library were to catch on fire. But I wonder, the only other author I can think of who moves me similarly is Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and the way he can just lure me into these horribly unsavory looks at culture and cruelty, but he also seems to be able to catch them in just unspeakable beauty, be it the sensuality of lovers or condensed milk or music or a glimpse at the natural world. And I wonder if you, and also the way his characters are able to maintain some idealism or some strength of human spirit, which is unexplainable to me. And I wonder if you had any affinity to that, to the magical realists, or how indeed, if you believe in the strength of human spirit in these conditions.
Well, I certainly believe in the human spirit. I think, you know, I think what saves this book in some way is the characters. I know what, in the end, you know, when one talks about how can one see any light in a novel which talks about such destruction, I think the characters themselves are the answer. But Marquez is interesting to me because I remember years ago when I read 100 Years of Solitude, which was, you know, quoted as magic realist and so forth, I thought, you know, this is a very realistic novel. You know, it could describe the landscape I grew up in Sri Lanka. You know, the surreal quality of the landscape and behavior seemed quite natural to me. So, I kind of bonded with Marquez, I think, with that book, but not in the sense of seeing it as kind of postmodern, whatever the terms are for a study of Marquez or a magic realist. So it was just wonderful writing that caught the way a good part of the world lives.
Jill, I'm so glad you asked the question. Could I ask, how should readers see Anil's Ghost in relation to The English Patient? I take it to be, as I said, just a little closer to our own time and our own world, and an even more marvelous read. How would you like to make that connection?
Well, I mean, I the book that I think that, I feel much closer to in some way. I mean, but I think we writers feel closer to the last books anyway, but I think that it seemed much more difficult book to write, and it was almost there was a real need to kind of celebrate, as I said earlier on, the characters of Anil and Kami and Ananda. I mean, I think that they're the characters I've loved most in my writing.
They're lovable characters. For me, at Gamini most especially. Michael Ondaatje, thank you enormously for joining us again. The book is Anil's Ghost, from the author of The English Patient, soon doubtless to be a major motion picture too. You can continue the conversation about Michael Ondaatje too and other Connection conversations on our website at theconnection.org. Jim Norris is our website producer. Thanks for help today from John Hoder, Nahani Rouse, Allison Bagg, Rebecca Smuckler, and Kim Bichari. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. Coming up next on Here and Now, the moving and spiritual sounds of singer Marian Anderson. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Wordsworth Books in Harvard Square.